Hello, and welcome to the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare. A little bit different, again, this week, as it is from week to week. You hear my voice starting the show, and you may think, it's just me, Adam Summers, by myself. That is not the case this week. I will be joined momentarily by my good, close, longtime personal friend, co-host of the Wrestling at Random podcast, and guest co-host for a segment on last episode, Jeremy Deemer, to talk about our live in-person front row experience at Windy City Riot in suburban Chicago last weekend. And then Mike will join me to talk about, I'm sure he'll have his thoughts on that show as well, if he attempted to stream it live. Bless his heart if he did, because apparently that didn't work out that well. And we'll talk about other things throughout the Japanese wrestling landscape as well. So we'll get to Mike in a little bit, but first, Jeremy, thank you for joining me again. It's two episodes in a row here on the Big Audio Nightmare. Almost said Wrestling at Random, but no, it is the Big Audio Nightmare here at F4WOnline.com.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's obviously I did so well that Mike allowed me to come back on the program. So thank you to both you and Mike for having me back. And boy, we've got a lot to talk about with this show.
We do. Mike, by the way, he finally got back to me a couple of days ago. I'd been pestering him to say, what did you think of Jeremy on the show? He finally got back to me and he said that your voice was calm and soothing. Excellent. Which I assume is just like Mike's voice. That's what we all think of when we think of Mike Sempervivi, calm and soothing.
Well, this show that we attended was neither calm nor soothing. And
I was soothed. I'll tell you what, when we walked in the building, you were fashionably near late.
But perfect timing to cut the line and join you walking right into the building.
Yeah, we were about 20 people from getting in the building after my friend Garrett and I had been waiting in line for a good 40 minutes. You pull up and get right in line with us as we're going in. I can't think of more calm or soothing scenes than sitting down front row and seeing the cerulean blue mat of the legitimate 20x20 New Japan Pro Wrestling ring. Talk about a sight that I've been waiting 30 years for. I've been thinking about going to a New Japan show since I was like 10 or 11 years old. So that alone, like, I felt like I got $50 worth of the way too much money that we paid for our front row tickets, just being that close to the New Japan ring.
Yeah, this was the first full New Japan show that we've gone to, because we did go to the Madison Square Garden New Japan Super Show, 11th row for that one, first row for this one. And yeah, the first thing I noticed about this ring is, holy cow, it is a lot stiffer of a ring than I'm used to seeing at a lot of live pro wrestling shows.
Yeah, no, we noticed that you had pointed that out right away before we even got to our seats, as the Wheeler Yuta and Rocky Romero versus Kevin Knight and DKC match was getting going. Even from a distance, you could definitely tell that. And it was different from the ring, if you recall, at that ROH New Japan Super Show at Madison Square Garden. It was sort of a combined effort, so it was not the normal New Japan ring. I, being the very pedantic fan that I am, I was wondering / slightly worried. And I think I either texted you or was going to text you saying, do you think they're going to bring the legit New Japan ring, or are we going to get the traveling one that's like 18x18 and very bouncy and isn't the cerulean blue mat that they do sometimes for the strong tapings? Here instead, we not only had the regulation New Japan ring, the cerulean blue canvas, we had a special New Japan USA Lion Mark logo on the front. It was strange to be in the Odeum, the place where you and I separately had been to the first ECW show in 1999 there and all the ones thereafter, to be in that building as it was, what, a month away from being torn down, but have the New Japan ring in the middle of it. It was a bit of a mind trip, I'll say.
Yeah, it was a great way to say goodbye to a building that you and I had both seen plenty of wrestling shows at. So yeah, it was definitely, this was the show to go out on.
Did you buy your seats? Did you see that sign when you're walking out? You can I think it was one seat for 50 or two for 75.
I did see that, and my connection to the Odeum, it's not like I sit in the same seats every time. It's not like, it's not like
you didn't have season tickets.
Yeah, Wrigley Field, they were renovating the seats and you could buy those, but it was the seats that you sat in all the time. This, the Odeum, no thanks. This was, you mentioned, we were arriving into the building during the dark match. The opening match still had a long line of people trying to get in. So if I don't know how it, I haven't seen the broadcast for the first match, but if it looked empty, it was because, or it looked not full. This was a legit sellout crowd. It was because the people were single file trying to get into the building, and it was a long line, and not everyone could cut the line like I did.
That's true. A couple of your friends, guys that I've been to shows with now several times as well, they got there a little bit later than you and I did, and I think their report was that when they got there, which was right around the time that the show was starting, the line was still all the way through the parking lot, and eventually event officials just came out and started scanning people's tickets while they were in line, so they could just get people through even sooner. So I guess that was the on-site snafu number one. The other one, which we won't get into too much between you and I because we were there live, but I do know there were a ton of problems with the live streaming of the show, at least on the Fight TV side, which I guess shouldn't be a surprise given I don't know a single human being who has ever had cell service in the Odeum other than in the bathroom. Have you noticed that? You pull your phone out and check your phone when you're in the bathroom, full five bars. The second you get out, it goes away. You just get bombarded with text messages that have been stuck in the ether when you're in the bathroom, and then it all goes away again when you go back out.
No, so many good jokes that I wanted to text out were held hostage on my phone because of the terrible, terrible cell service. So, yeah, it's a shame that the Fight TV broadcast had so many issues because this was a super fun show. And I'm disappointed that people, you know, were frustrated during the viewing of it because, man, it was it got off to an auspicious start, and but it quickly turned around from there. I was nervous that we'd made a terrible, terrible mistake after the opening contest.
Yes, the opening contest being the factory trio of Nick Camarado, Aaron Solo, and QT Marshall defeating the LA Dojo trio of Carl Fredericks, Clark Connors, and Yuya Uemura with a finish that can only be described as an elaborate troll job on Adam Summers, having spent this much money to sit front row, as QT Marshall pinned Yuya Uemura with a diamond cutter. I'm sure this will go somewhere. I would imagine we'll see a rematch of sorts, maybe on Dark or Dark Elevation at some point. But man, was not thrilled by that finish. I get it. You get heat, whatever. But man, I just wanted to see. I didn't expect Uemura to win, but I was thinking maybe, you know, Clark Connors would pin Aaron Solo to gain a little bit of USA momentum before he hopefully goes to the Best of the Super Junior tournament. None of that happened here, unfortunately.
No, so I was questioning our decision to sit ringside for this, but that was quickly. I was put at ease as the next match kicked off, and we had. A lot of good stuff here.
A lot of men. This was five on five, and somehow not the most men that would be involved in a tag team match. That'll come a few matches later.
A lot of multiple man matches, but they were all fun. This one was great. We got to see, you had Fred Rosser, Chris Dickinson, Josh Alexander, Red Narita, and Alex Coughlin in victorious over Black Tiger, J.R. Kratos, Nelson, Isaacs, and Limelight. Now, the highlight of the match, of course, was J.R. Kratos's insane dive over the post to the floor. Absolutely nuts.
Yeah, if you watch New Japan Strong and you've seen Jarrett Kratos, you know, hard, heavy-hitting dude, big, mean, scary, tough guy, fits that role for Team Filthy perfectly. He's been in the feud of sorts with Alex Coghlan after Coghlan beat Kratos to get his first win at the end of his trial series. But JR Kratos hit a no-hands dive. The best way I can describe it is an Undertaker WrestleMania dive, but he hit it over the corner post instead of over the ropes. Just a wild scene. A guy that big. And he, it wasn't like he struggled. He easily cleared the top corner, cleared the post, and landed onto the pile of humanity on the floor. It was something else to see. I mean, other things to me in this match, we didn't get to see a ton of them, unfortunately, but Ren Narita, much like Yuya Uemura, totally different style, but much like Uemura, just came off like such a star here. I talked about it, I think, on the last podcast, and I definitely wrote about it in Three Count Fall, how Narita seems to have turned another corner. The match he had with Rocky Romero at Lone Star Shootout a couple weeks ago, he looks like he's ready to be a main roster New Japan star. And even in limited action here, he definitely had that same presence.
No, watching both those guys, Yuya and Ren Narita, they're selling. Just, it's improved leaps and bounds. They are so talented and just ready to break out. It was great to see them live and up close in person there, and you could really see the little things that they were doing.
Uemura, particularly with his selling, I've talked about it before, that wherever he goes, whether it's West Coast Pro or Bloodsport or New Japan Strong or here a big New Japan USA pay-per-view event, he's always, even with fans that don't know him, he always gets over so immediately as just such a pure babyface. And there's so many elements of guys that came before him, whether it be, you know, a Tatsumi Fujinami or a Hiroshi Tanahashi is such an obvious influence or comparison. And then you see him throw an arm drag, or you see him throw those double chops, and you're like, man, someone's been showing him, or he's been watching himself a ton of young Ricky Steamboat as well. And the selling too fits in there as well.
Yeah. And that match, the finish of that match rolled right into Tom Lawler defending the New Japan Strong Openweight Championship against Yuji Nagata. And what an ovation for Yuji Nagata. The people that were there to see the stars of New Japan.
Yes.
And the Chicago crowd was great. They brought it all night. We were blowing up midway through the show, but we were able to keep it going, and so was the Chicago crowd. They were able to keep it going throughout the entire show. They're always good crowds in Chicago, but this one was here for the stars of New Japan, and they were just absolutely going nuts for Yuji Nagata making his way out.
Yeah, this was, I mean, well, obviously there were AEW fans there, and you saw some AEW merch. This was not like an AEW crowd ported into a New Japan show. Like you said, these people knew who all the key players were, whether it was, you know, a young lion on excursion like Uemura or a legend like Nagata. You know, his music hit, the reaction. As you said, this came right on the heels of Fred Rosser submitting Black Tiger with the crossface chicken wing, and then Black Tiger and Tom Lawler beating Fred Rosser down, which that, you know, seems to be building to Rosser getting another title shot for the Strong Openweight title. Then Nagata came out to make the save and was able to convince Tom Lawler to put the title on the line for a match that would have otherwise been and was originally scheduled to be a non-title match. The other thing before we get into the match, any thoughts that you had, I just was thinking as Nagata came out and he got that reaction, just how different this felt from the last time Yuji Nagata had been in this building for that. I think it's the last time Ring of Honor sent over New Japan guys, or New Japan guys got sent over to work a Ring of Honor show, when I think Nagata was on that show, Sonata, Evil. And it was, there couldn't have been more than 400 people there. It was so empty. There was no atmosphere. I don't think Ring of Honor even used the actual New Japan music for any of the guys, which also didn't help the reactions. But you just look at that compared to this, where the building was jam-packed and people were hyped to see Nagata.
They had the music. They had the videos. Like yes. The video screens were all the New Japan videos as well. And so
we had the vertical banners that are similar to what you'd see at a major New Japan show, you know, saying New Japan Pro Wrestling. We should also note that throughout the like the lobby in the front entrance area, they had big backdrops for Bullet Club, for United Empire, the New Japan Lion Mark logo, you know, so people could take pictures by those big backdrop logos. So they went all out to make this feel like a real New Japan show.
Yeah, and I'm a huge Tom Lawler fan, so I loved getting to see him in Nagata because you could tell he was having a great time.
Oh, yeah.
and the last time I saw Tom Lawler live in person was taking on Minoru Suzuki in a high school gym in South Suburban Chicago.
That Warrior Wrestling show.
Yeah, yeah.
So this couple months first, before the pandemic.
Yeah, this is the first time I've seen him live since then. And yeah, fun match with Yuji Nagata, Yuji playing the hits, and Tom Lawler with a great showing and successfully defends the open weight championship.
Yep, with a kamigoye of sorts, cross arm kamigoye to the back of the head, if I'm not mistaken. Who knows? Tom Lawler has been vocal in recent days, calling out one Kota Ibushi and his delivery of the kamigoye. So maybe tuck that in your back pocket for when Ibushi gets that last 20% back to being at full health. But this was a really fun match. And the thing I said to you when it was over was, like, looking at Nagata, whatever he's going to lose as far as speed or dexterity, that's already gone. And what's left is a guy who is still really good. And I could see him doing a match at this exact level still 10 years from now. Like, I think he's, you know, it's going to be a little while before he drops off any further. And where he's at is still very, very good. And it's so fun seeing him live, seeing the, seeing the crowd reaction to him, seeing him work a crowd. It's a guy who just got, you know, decades of experience, so many different places. And Jesus, we both saw him live on Nitro. An episode of Monday Nitro at the United Center in 1997. And there we were some 25 years later, seeing him again live front row at New Japan.
Not going to lie, I was appreciating him more now than I did at that Nitro.
Totally understandable. He's accomplished a lot between now and then.
And now we'll the... another multi-man match. This time,
the multiest man match, maybe in wrestling history.
The United Empire, we'll get to them in a minute, are taking on the Bullet Club team as Gallows and Anderson, Chris Bay, El Fantasmo, and Hikuleo come out. They all point to the back, and out emerges Scott Norton and. Scott Norton getting a Legends-esque reaction from the crowd. I was happy, and even during his performance, the crowd was gonna support his the legend in the ring here and try you know, they were gonna will him to get some spots in and have a good appearance against the Empire. The United Empire, there's one man to talk about, the star of the show, my hero, your hero, the great Okan. What a guy.
A true hero, a true superhero, as Jeff Cobb said to us several times at ringside. And man, for a guy who, to me, this was going to be one of the most interesting things about the show, in that the great Okan had not yet becoming the Great Okan, he had not appeared in the United States. I think his only other U.S. appearance may have been while he was on Excursion. There was a New Japan USA show that he was on, and I guess it was at the very early stages of him being the Great Okan, but the character wasn't fully formed. He didn't have quite this look. And a lot of people were wondering, will he be over? That question got answered very quickly. The people loved them some Great Okan. The Great Okan loved him, the people, and not only in this match, but throughout the night, I'm struggling to remember a better corner man that I've seen in wrestling, because a lot of this match, when it's 6-on-6, you're just in the corner cheering on your teammates, or as we saw him later with Ospreay, just fully engaged, just totally got it as far as how to work a type of crowd that he hadn't really been in front of before.
No, he was the MVP. He was everywhere all the time. You couldn't stop looking at him, and he was busy, and he was doing stuff, and he was in the action, and yeah, as Jeff Cobb reminded us, guy's a hero, and we loved ourselves some great Okan. We didn't get to see a ton of him in the ring.
No, but
he made up for it with his antics outside the ring.
We did get to see some Mongolian chops, some real legitimate ownership Mongolian chops. We didn't have any odium oscillating forearms or whatever Kevin Kelly would have called it if Tenzan was there in the building that night. These were legitimate Mongolian chops. Outside of that, like you said, we didn't get to see a ton of him. We should mention this was the first time I believe that the entirety of the United Empire was all on one show at the same time. In addition to Will Ospreay in the main event, the six United Empire members here, the Great Okan, Jeff Cobb, TJP, Kyle Fletcher, and Mark Davis of Aussie Open, and Aaron Henare, who I don't recall making any U.S. appearances. And we should shout out Henare as well, because he didn't have a whole lot to do in this match. But I thought he was great. His reactions to things that were happening in the ring, he's such a his like righteous indignation face, and his being shocked at a babyface ever doing anything well face is as good as it gets. He was very entertaining on the floor.
And the dude can rock a suit. He wore it well. Yeah, looked like $1 million there. Yeah, no, this was a good match. Fun. We got some, you know, some Scott Norton spots as
Scott Norton Jeff Cobb interaction, which was all I wanted out of this match.
That's what we wanted. We got that in the Mongolian chops. Hikuleo, big guy, tall guy.
Yes, he's one of those guys that as tall as he looks on TV. It does not do justice to how tall the man is in person, much like the Great Okan, as charismatic as he is on TV. It does not do any justice to how he comes off in person.
That's right. And the next match featured a guy just as charismatic when he came out. Another big guy, Brody King, teaming with Finjuice. And
well, let's go back first quickly to that 12-man tag, because we did have a finish of Kyle Fletcher pinning Chris Bay. And then afterward, I don't know, it's a match that anyone is dying to see, but it looks like it's going to be made. It looks like they're building towards Jeff Cobb and the Great Okan defending against the Good Brothers.
Yeah, that's a match. No, that I'm not a huge Good Brothers fan. But,
mostly for me, it's because I'm not a huge Doc Gallows fan. Like, he's fine, but Carl Anderson can be such a great singles wrestler. At least he was a decade ago in New Japan. That if he's in New Japan, I want to see the Carl Anderson that wrestled Okada, not the Carl Anderson that, you know, is teaming with Doc Gallows.
Yeah, honorable mention to Aussie Open as well for their improvements since last time we saw them live, which was 2019 WrestleMania weekend. We saw them live. That was my first time seeing them in person. A lot more polished, a lot less indie-rific at points.
Yeah, a lot more interesting in-between moves, too, and also great on the floor when they weren't in the ring. They were, I think you and I had both had the same reaction after having heard so much about them and then seeing them live in 2019. I just remember being really kind of underwhelmed. Whereas here it was like, oh, wow. Okay. This is what in my head, what I imagined they were in 2019.
Much more polished.
From hearing how people had talked about them back then, that's how they actually seem now. So I'm excited to see when things open up, then become a fixture in the New Japan Tag Team Division.
So this was a farewell to Juice Robinson and David Finlay, fixtures of the Tag Team Division for many years.
Particularly Juice. We don't know yet about David Finlay, but Juice Robinson has flat out came out and said, I think with Mike on Wrestling Observer Live, that his contract was up with New Japan. He had signed a 3-month extension in January, and this was the last show, and going forward
he did his goodbye victory lap at the end of the show. He was saying goodbye. His lovely wife, Toni Storm, was in attendance.
Really? I did not know that.
Yes, she was in the section right behind us, not on the floor, but just above the floor there, just off the floor. So Brody King, Finn Juice, defeating Bad Dude Tito, Shane Haste, and Jonah. Now, this was a street fight. This was a battle going all over the arena, and you went back to your indie wrestling days and decided to chase the action.
Oh yes, Garrett and I at the prompting of my friend Garrett, we got up and we followed the action, and I almost got taken out a few times. There was one point where Jonah and David Finlay were brawling on the stage, and I got right up against the guardrail near the stage to take a picture. And then a security guy told me, "You need to move right now." I moved right then. And about 10 seconds later, I can't remember who, but somebody got thrown right into the spot of the guardrail where I was standing against. So that kind of set the scene for the action converging around me. At one point, I think it was Juice busted out a fire extinguisher, which I was far too close to. And while wearing a KN95 mask, still had quite the burning sensation in my nose from the fire extinguisher.
Everybody did, no matter how far away you were from that. This was a legit fire extinguisher. And everybody was like covering their nose there after that one. Because
emptied it.
Yeah, even the security guy next to me was like, he was not thrilled about being this close to that fire extinguisher going off.
Let's briefly mention that, by the way, because that's another one of the things that separated this from any other wrestling show that I've been to. New Japan in the USA tries to replicate the scenario that you have at shows in Japan, where you've got the Young Lions around ringside, other staff members around ringside that are there to, among other things, hold the guardrails in place so that when wrestlers get whipped into the guardrails don't go flying at you. So the combination of that, we had a guy right in our corner. And then the fact that there's a good 4 feet between where your feet are when you're sitting down in the front row and where the guardrail is, it made for far less of a perilous experience in front row than I can remember, for example, being at Ring of Honor shows where I broke a bone in my hand pounding on the guardrail like an idiot, or, having guardrails going flying at your knees. So that was a nice touch to see.
Or at a similar Nitro where I was sitting ringside and Raven was whipped into the guardrail and knocked over my beer.
There you go.
Yeah. So in this match, the big spot, one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen live was the ladder bridge with Brody King on it. The splash from Jonah, putting him through the ladder, just absolutely terrifying to
putting him through the ladder. That is not you speaking out of turn. Jonah, who is a massive human being, just a huge ball of angry mass, jumped off the top rope with a big splash onto Brody King, who was on the ladder, and they went through this steel ladder. I have never seen anything like that in my life.
These were ladders and chairs from the Odeum in Villa Park. These weren't like brought in specially or gimmicked or anything. These were all those chairs, we were sitting on the exact same chairs, and they were all throughout the Odeum. So these were legit Odeum supplied tools. This ladder snapping like that was absolutely scary.
When Juice and Finlay were getting all those chairs and bringing them into the ring, I did for a split second worry that the fans were going to get a little too ECW nostalgic and start throwing the chairs into the ring. I'm like, please.
We did get a chant. We got an ECW chant. It almost crossed that line.
Yeah, I was worried. I'm like, as cool of a visual as that would be, I'm in the front row. I don't want to get hit by chairs. and even more so, there are a lot of matches still. There are 3 matches left on this show that I really want to see. I don't want this show to get shut down. Thankfully, people resisted the urge. The carnage continued.
Yeah, we got to see. So with the victory, we got to see Finlay and Juice celebrate together, say their goodbyes as Juice rides off to the sunset for whatever's next in his life, whatever he wants to do next. So it was a fun match.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I've seen some people say that it was just painfully long watching it on the stream. Maybe so, but to me, I was engaged the whole way through live. Maybe part of it, again, was that I was more in the middle of it than I should have been for the out of the ring part of it. I think also, if you've been following the feud with TMDK and Juice and Finlay over the last month or two on Strong, like, it's been done very well. There have been some great brawls that led to this street fight. So, I mean, it worked for me. They brawled. It was a feud ending match that felt like a fight. We had come as you are dress. Guys had knee pads on over their boots. They were wearing, knee pads on over their jeans. Nobody was wearing wrestling gear. I assume you probably didn't like the fact that Bad Dude Tito and Juice were on opposite teams and yet were dressed exactly alike.
Especially it's Juice's night. Like, hey, Tito, find something else to wear or lose the tank top. Yeah.
Yeah, wear a black tank top instead of the white.
Exactly. Yeah. The come down match after that was Jay White coming out for his mystery challenge, the US of Jay Open Challenge continuing, and no letdown here. We're right back up because we see a video with Moxley in the back telling the shooter to go for it, and the place went nuts when they saw Umino with Moxley's leather jacket,
the Death Riders jacket.
Yeah, fantastic. So this was exciting to see him in person as well. So we're getting to see all the young lions.
Yeah, it was very exciting on a couple levels. First off, again, to your point earlier about this being a New Japan crowd, I'd seen a lot of speculation online leading into the show, people saying, oh my God, is it going to be CM Punk as the mystery opponent? Is it going to be Claudio Castagnoli? Who could it be? Thinking about, you know, every possible, you know, American free agent or American wrestling free agent. Here it's Shota Umino, a guy who was a young lion, then went on an excursion. It's been an excursion in Rev Pro, which I don't think very many people there watch. And yet he came out and people were into it. They were excited that he was the surprise. So that's, I'm very happy for him that people didn't view that as a letdown and really get on him, because given how somewhat star-crossed his excursion has been, and now how finally lately in the last 6 months or so, he's been healthy and been able to build a little bit of momentum. It would have been really a downer if the people weren't into seeing him here.
No, the people really, they were into it. Jay White put on a great performance, as he always does.
He is so good. And we always talk about the little things on Wrestling at Random. I know Mike and I talk about that on here as well. When you watch Jay White live up close, like, you really get a sense of how on another level he is at all those little things compared to most guys, just being fully engaged in being Jay White from the time he comes through the curtain, and the way he goes for pins, and the way he's frustrated when a guy kicks out, the way he gets on the referee, like, he's as good as it gets.
Umino with the selling the injury, the ribs are hurt, and this was a great match. Jay White with the victory, and we go to my match of the night.
I think everybody's match of the night, but let's go back to Umino for a second first, because I saw some people saying, you know, wondering, okay, like, how did Umino look? What's everyone's thoughts about how Shota Umino looked here? I thought, to your point in terms of the selling, I thought he was fantastic on that end. This was maybe the best I've seen him since he's been on excursion in terms of selling, emoting, drawing fans into what he's doing as a babyface, fighting back, getting sympathy from a crowd that some people knew him, some people didn't. I was very impressed by that. I worry a little bit. I still think he's nowhere near a finished product yet on the offense side, particularly given how much, I don't want to say pressure is on him, but I guess you could say it that way. There's a lot of people that look at him as the next big main event level star, as far as on the Japanese side in New Japan, because we talked about Uemura. He's, you know, he's a class later. He's a little further away. He to me is going to be the big star, but he's a little further away. Narita's going to be a star, but I don't think he's, you know, an ace type wrestler for the style that New Japan is pushing right now. Whereas Umino, in theory, is that guy, but there's definitely more work that needs to be done on the offense side. Like that weird reverse neckbreaker thing that he's yes. been doing and he did here just didn't work. He still, to me, is trying to figure out like what his offense is going to be for kind of the type of wrestler he is. And I feel like right now he might be a half step slow ring speed wise or just sort of ring IQ wise for the stuff that he's trying to do. And that's what Excursion is for. But I think people who maybe didn't realize or don't realize kind of how screwed up the first year or so of his Excursion was with injuries and illness, I think they may expect him to be a little bit further along than he is on that end.
Yeah, and trying to work out that offense now that he's put on a little more size, too.
For sure.
Definitely looks a lot bigger, a lot thicker now.
Well, so. he's that's a really good point because his body type is, I don't think it, and I'm not talking about like muscles or anything, but just the way his body is distributed doesn't necessarily do him favors for some of the stuff he's trying to do. He's not a particularly tall guy, and then he's got very short arms and very short legs. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see. I almost think he might be the type of wrestler that is better served to be a bit slower paced and methodical and be more of a guy that's leading a match rather than coming back. But where he's slotted and the type of character he has right now, which, I mean, you can just see from the haircut, the gear they give him, they're trying to make people think of Tanahashi when they see him. He's more of that classic babyface. So it'll be interesting to see how the next year or so goes and when they feel like they can pull the trigger on bringing him back. Because we all know on the Japan side, they desperately need.
Oh, yes.
A fresh, young Japanese babyface to come back and be a guy in the main event scene. But, you know, as much as they need it, they can't rush it. And he's not ready just yet.
It's time to talk about Tomohiro Ishii defeating Minoru Suzuki.
Oh my
God. I think this is the closest thing to a G1 match I've ever experienced live.
Yeah. I would say outside of maybe in a different way, the IWGP heavyweight title match that we saw at MSG.
Sure.
With Okada and Jay White, but that was a great IWGP title match. This was 18 minutes and 46 seconds once you get past the entrances where you felt...
It felt like 7 minutes.
Well, it felt like 7 minutes, but you felt like you were transported to a big G1 show in Japan. It was... Yes. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we paid a fair bit of money for these tickets. This match was everything that I wanted out of a front row New Japan Pro Wrestling experience and then some. Like, if this was the only thing on the show, I would have still felt like I got a bargain given what we paid for these tickets. It was, I mean, everything. The entrances, the anticipation from the fans, you know, before the music hit, you know, they had the video and people are freaking out then. Just the atmosphere. I've been to, as of you, a ton of wrestling shows, and the only thing that I can say compares to this as a live wrestling experience, the overall package of this match for me would have been Samoa Joe versus Kenta Kobashi in 2005 in New York City. That obviously was a much more historic match in terms of Kobashi making a rare appearance in the U.S., wrestling Samoa Joe. You know, that being in 2005, but here, like, I chase the feeling as a wrestling fan that I had for this match. You don't get it very often. I could count on one hand the amount of times I've gotten it and had it here in spades. If you watch the match back closely, you can see both Jeremy and I losing our minds in the front row multiple times.
And so, you know, we said the crowd was here for the stars of New Japan, right? And they had expectations. They had expectations for what this match was going to be. And if they came out and did anything less than this, I think people would have been a little disappointed because people wanted exactly this. These guys came out and, you know, they're in front of the cheering crowd and they're in front of the crowd that's just going nuts for everything they're doing. And they gave it 110%. And it was everything that this crowd wanted. They delivered. And yeah, satisfied was exactly how this crowd felt after this match. The only criticism I have is I was screaming in terror at some of those headbutts. Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
You could hear it from where we were sitting. It was disgusting. It was just, that was the only thing I could have done without. Everything else, chef's kiss.
Yeah, the headbutts, particularly as someone who still has not been able to go back and watch Okada and Shibata as anywhere near as many times as I would like because of that headbutt. That was a bit much. But talk about loud sounds. Those wind-up forearms that Suzuki throws, man, a couple of those were loud. We had a couple of great spots where it looked like Ishii was going to come back and then Suzuki would stop him with that forearm. And just, you know, you talk about working a crowd and the little things, just Suzuki, just his reactions when he was getting stomped down in the corner and stepped on, and the little sort of I guess I would call them prick kicks, for lack of better description, from Ishii. And then Suzuki just looks out to the crowd and looks back at Ishii. So much of that got the crowd going as much as the actual physical contact itself. And then seeing Ishii up close and personal in a, you know, a big one-on-one match like this, and his selling, his firing up, you talk about being able to take a crowd along with him for the ride. We'd seen him live before, but that was at Rev Pro. As far as a big singles match against David Starr, which for a multitude of reasons, I'll just say he's no Minoru Suzuki. So this was
understatement of the year.
So this was, again, this was everything you could have possibly wanted out of this. I mean, there were so many times in this match where I was just, you know, hands on the top of my head, freaking out. And just, you know, like you said, 19 minutes that felt like seven, and you just completely lose yourself in the match, suspend all disbelief, and you are like, I was going as crazy in this match as I would be and as I was at like game seven of a Blackhawks playoff series.
Yep.
You know, that's what it made you feel like. And again, like I said, that is, as a wrestling fan, what you chase. I go back to Joe Kobashi. We talked about Okada and Jay White. I think back to the Samoa Joe CM Punk 2 in Ring of Honor many years ago, that match. Like, those are those things that, you know, you don't get very often, but when you do, you remember it for a long time. And I think this is one that, for as long as I'm around, I'll remember that 20 minutes as vividly as it gets.
It was so great. And then as soon, you can't even exhale after the match because Eddie Kingston comes out.
Yes.
A total surprise, a huge reaction for Eddie Kingston. Turns out he's popular. And he comes out and challenges Ishii after the match. They will have a match in Washington, D.C.
Yes, on the May 14th Capital Collision Show, which is shaping up to be a big show. And by the end of the night here in Chicago, that DC show got even bigger. That takes us to the main event, special singles match. We had wondered, how do you follow Ishii and Suzuki? Well, Moxley and Ospreay, they did their damnedest.
Challenge accepted from these guys.
Yes. This was a fight. It was wild just to see these two guys in the ring against each other. Such different styles and just paths that have not crossed yet. Two guys that are, you know, at or near the best of the world in completely different ways. And so whenever you see that, you know, we've talked about it on this podcast before, how you get wildly divergent styles of wrestlers, and you kind of wonder which guy's match are they going to do. And this is one where they really did kind of split the difference. We had a lot of Moxley brawling, but Ospreay was able to get in enough Will Ospreay stuff that it didn't feel like he was just being taken along for the ride. I mean, my God, that top rope moonsault to the floor in the first few minutes of the match. If that didn't tell you that Ospreay was ready and pumped for this, I don't know what would.
No, perfect shooting star press later in the match. Yeah.
Which almost looks like when you see him do a shooting star press, it looks so easy. Like he's the only guy that when you see him do it, you think, yeah, he could probably do a double shooting star press, a double flip, and he'd be fine.
Yeah, this was a well-balanced match between the two styles. And we had blood, a lot of Moxley bleeding.
Well, and I think that came legitimately from when Ospreay wildly threw that chair from when he had gotten thrown over the guardrail, then he threw a chair at Moxley as Moxley was coming at him. He was bleeding, and it appeared to be cuts in several different spots that did not stop.
And this was our first time, you mentioned it earlier, the entire United Empire was together. This is the first time we got to see them all together with Will Ospreay as well. So yes. The whole crew at ringside not interfering at all in the match.
And no,
just being good cheerleaders and supporters.
As they never do. That's the one thing about the United Empire that separates them from the Bullet Club / House of Torture is that they're at ringside. They give moral support. They yell. They give advice. We saw that a lot between Jeff Cobb and Will Ospreay during the New Japan Cup, but they never interfere. The other thing that I greatly appreciated about the United Empire was that while they were all in our corner, we were on that side directly behind them. I would assume at the behest of the very heroic and gentlemanly Great O'Conn, they all were kneeling rather than standing up.
Oh, yeah. Jeff Cobb grabbed a chair, directly in front of me in a chair. This was
recorded some of the match on his phone. I hope he doesn't post any GIFs or TV Asahi will get the Jeff Cobb Twitter account banned.
Yeah, so they were great. O'Conn running around was great. This match was fantastic. It was this was another long match that flew by. This match seemed I was shocked when I saw the actual runtime for this match because this was
21:24.
Yeah, this did not feel like a 20-minute match at all. There was no it was well paced. To where there wasn't like a lull or drag at all. It kept going at a pace that was just, it was relentless. And it was 20 minutes that flew by again.
Yeah. There was a sense of urgency the whole time, you know, which I think for some people probably, you know, they maybe would go back to that street fight and say they're, you know, similar match lengths and say that one dragged because there wasn't necessarily that sense of urgency. Whereas here, there was the only knock on this that I could give, because this was on its way to being, well, not being at the level of Ishii versus Suzuki, not terribly far off it. The finish, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what happened here, because you have to look at it through the lens of what happened with Ospreay in the New Japan Cup, where he beats Sonata. They do the whole thing where Red Shoes feels bad that he waited too long to stop the match. When Ospreay, you know, is just raining elbows down on Sonata. So the next match of Ospreay is against Zack Sabre Jr. ZSJ gets a nasty submission on Ospreay. Red Shoes thinks Ospreay is tapping, and it looks like he did. But, you know, Ospreay says he didn't. Calls for the bell. Matches over. ZSJ wins. So we fast forward to here where Moxley hits a Death Rider or a Paradigm Shift, depending on which company you're in. But we'll call it a Death Rider here. I believe he had a couple of them. He goes for the pin. It looks like Ospreay kicks out. And then Moxley locks on the rear naked choke, which seemed like that was going to be the actual finish, that Ospreay was going to kick out of the Death Rider, but then give up to the rear naked choke. And my thought was that maybe the ref got confused and that the sort of controversial part of this was supposed to be, again, that Ospreay was trying to get out of the submission hold and the referee was going to call a tap, but instead the referee counted three when it was supposed to be two, And they're running with that as the story of how Ospreay got screwed. It was very awkward live. I don't think it came off exactly how they intended.
No, there was a lot of confusion in the crowd, but you jumped right on it right after it happened. I'm like, what the heck was that? And you're like, oh, this has to be a continuation of the Ospreay getting screwed by the referees. And I'm like, ah, New Japan Cup. Yeah, I'm back. Okay, all right. So, I didn't hear the play-by-play. I didn't hear how Kevin Kelly describes what was happening here, if they were describing it similarly. But it felt like, because it went right into the choke and the tap, it felt like the referee should not have counted three and did anyway. And it looked like a pretty obvious kick out from ringside.
Absolutely. And we weren't blocked. We could see it. I was not thinking that it was a finish. And then like 5 seconds later, the bell is ringing, but it definitely was not a three count.
No, and then Moxley lays out the referee at the end of the match, and then challenges Tanahashi to a match again in Washington, D.C. He's going to go drag him by that ponytail over to Washington, D.C. To have a match. He did put over Will Ospreay
for
answering the challenge. He said what an amazing wrestler he was and what a great match they had.
And what a fighter he was, making a point to say that he didn't give up. He didn't, he didn't back down, that sort of thing.
So that was all great. A different ending, and we're talking about that match for a lot more than we actually ended up doing. And so this the show ends here with this Tanahashi announcement, which I know you were bummed we didn't get that match here.
Yeah, a little bit. I was thinking beforehand that might be something we would get here, but. Tanahashi was in Japan. A lot of the heavyweights, a lot of the main roster guys in Japan for the New Japan All Japan joint show celebrating the 60th anniversary of Korakuen Hall. So given that, and the fact that outside of Young Lions, we only had, four guys in Suzuki, Ishii, Nagata, and Okan that you could call main roster guys, this ended up being a hell of a show. I still wish we would have gotten Tanahashi versus Moxley. That challenge goes way, way back. I mean, think to on Dynamite pre-Moxley taking his time away to go to rehab, and Moxley was calling out Tanahashi on AEW television. It seemed like they were going toward that direction after the Moxley-Kojima match that we saw at All Out. So DC's finally getting that. They're getting Ishii versus Eddie Kingston. Okada is on that show as well, so you'd have to think there's going to be a big Okada match. And who knows, the Moxley Tanahashi match could be for the U.S. title, because we've got coming up in a few weeks Ospreay and Tanahashi wrestling in a decision match of sorts to determine the new U.S. heavyweight champion, with Sonata out for injury. So if you're in the D.C. area, as Mike Sempervivi is, it looks like you're going to be getting a pretty damn good show. And hopefully, if you're not the DC area, the Fight TV feed situation will be a little bit better than it was apparently for this show.
We've been calling for New Japan to come to Chicago. We've been begging New Japan to come to Chicago. They go everywhere that's not Chicago. And we're like, why? Why do they hate us? Why won't they come here? Chicago loves New Japan. They will come out in force to support New Japan, and they did. I was proud of the Chicago crowd. I was happy. I was over the moon with the show we got, and what a farewell to the Odeum, saying goodbye to so many shows we've seen in the past there, all of the ghosts of ECW and others. This is a fine way to say goodbye to that building, with just a great show in those last two matches just being exceeding the expectations we had going in.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. And as we were walking out, I noticed New Japan president Obari watching as everyone was leaving the show. And even though he was wearing a mask, you could still see just in his eyes how wide he was smiling. seeing this huge crowd of the in the Odeon, you know, sell out of around 2,100 people filing out, you could tell that he and by extension New Japan were very happy with how this show came off, at least from a live crowd standpoint. So I would think in whatever form that takes, I would be very surprised if Chicago doesn't become a yearly stop, an annual stop for the U.S. side of New Japan going forward, whether that be a big show like this or a strong taping or some sort of co-promoted situation. I don't think the Lion Mark will be a stranger to the Chicago metropolitan area going forward.
No, and thanks again to Mike Sempervivi for letting me sit in to recap what is just a fantastic show. So, again, thanks for having me on. Glad to be back.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you for joining me, Jeremy, and we'll be back momentarily, as this time it's Mike Sempervivi reaching through the airwaves to make the hot tag. Jeremy is ducking under the ropes, and Mike is heading in.
Damn. Now that was a hot tag.
Yes. I think Jeremy is still fired up for the from the Windy City Riot show. Yeah, we didn't intend to talk as long as we did, but apparently we talked for almost an hour, Jeremy and I did, and in that time, New Japan announced another major show in Chicago.
Man, you're taking it back to the old PPH days there, the originations of this show. You're going to go on for 4 hours now. We have to, now that you've done an hour with him. We've got to talk for at least 3.5 hours. Just about Washington, D.C. and Capitol Collision on May 14th.
Yes, that's right. If this was the PPH, though, we would be doing around, I don't know, let's say 9 hours of recording to get 90 minutes of audio. So we're at least more efficient.
This is true. And it seems as though New Japan's getting a little bit more efficient on sending over names here. Now that things are opening up, we have forbidden doors being kicked open all over the place. We had rumors of Wrigley Field being ran, and those didn't end up coming to fruition, but there is going to be another present for those of you in Chicago, the official home of AEW. Forget about Jacksonville. If Chicago's not it, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, there are some benefits to living in Chicago, it appears. But before we get to everything about the Forbidden Door joint pay-per-view that was just announced hours ago by Tony Khan and Takami Obari of New Japan Pro Wrestling, you've got something to look forward to as well on the New Japan front, because Capital Collision is coming to Washington, D.C. less than a month from now. And as I touched on a little bit with Jeremy a few minutes ago, that card's not looking too bad either, with Tomohiro Ishii against Eddie Kingston, and Hiroshi Tanahashi and John Moxley, plus whoever Kazuchika Okada wrestles. It sounds like that'll be a pretty solid show to go to as well.
Not bad. Not bad at all. Jay White probably going to do his US of J Open Challenge on that show. Okada, Tanahashi and Moxley, Ishii. I mean, not much to complain about. Not a bad debut for coming into DC. So,
and it looks like ticket sales have gone pretty well from what I can tell so far. It looks like most of the floor has been sold, and you know, there's, you know, sold some of the I don't know if you really call it upper levels. It's not a huge building. It's the building they ran in DC for Dynamite and Rampage last time, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a relatively new building that's been set up in Southeast D.C., St. Elizabeth's out that way. The Sports and Entertainment, the very creatively named Sports and Entertainment Center that...
I wonder if there'll be a Jericho run-in at the New Japan show.
The Washington Wizards use it as their practice arena, and then the Mystics and the Washington Go-Go. The NBA D League team or G League.
Washington Go-Go?
Go-Go, baby. That's right.
So is Taguchi on this team? Is Prince David on this team?
You know what? Taguchi. I can see Taguchi out there playing the bongos, DC tradition, playing traditional go-go music. And in fact, probably the greatest or most widely known go-go song would be EU's Debut, which means Taguchi would be perfect to jump in there with the hip and Sugar Bear and say, ow. but that's dating myself and also making it very regional. But, you know, I don't care because
I think that's also known as the Mike Sempervivi experience.
Yes, it is. And I'm going to be full up to here with that experience. I'm looking forward to seeing Filthy Tom Lawler and hanging out with him as well as everybody else. And again, you know, with Tanahashi, you know, the tickets on the floor, they're expensive. I think they were, I'm not sure what yours were. They're around that price.
They were enough.
Yeah, I think
it was 100% worth it. As I talked about Jeremy a few minutes ago, Ishii versus Suzuki alone was, you know, if the power had gone out before and after that match and just stayed on for that 18 minutes and 26 seconds, I would have felt like I got my money's worth.
I think it was $299 for the front row, and those are all gone. I think it's $199 for what the rest of the floor was, and those are gone. So there's only a handful left. And, yeah, like you mentioned, there's only seats that are up top left. So it looks like they're probably going to sell this thing out in all likelihood.
Yeah.
It's, you know, with the ticket prices and, again, the amount of merch, I have a feeling that they're going to sell. It's probably going to be a pretty good trip to the East Coast.
Yeah, I would think so. And yeah, to your point, considering the tickets they've sold already and Okada's match hasn't been announced yet, I would think they'll get pretty close to a sellout, at least 80-90% full, if not more. So yeah, let's not bury the lead any longer, because as people listen to this, they're probably about close to an hour, 5 hour, 10 into this podcast, and I'm sure they're dying to know our thoughts on the big announcement, the huge announcement, as it were, from Tony Khan Wednesday night on AEW Dynamite that, yes, in fact, the Forbidden Door, and boy, are people going to be tired of hearing that phrase between now and June. But the Forbidden Door has been opened, and New Japan versus/with AEW at the United Center of all places in Chicago. As I tweeted right after the announcement was made, it's easy to forget how ice cold the relationship was between these two companies when AEW launched, or even before they launched, when they were announced to be launching. I mean, I think back to when we were sitting 11th row for ROH New Japan at Madison Square Garden, and you and I were just talking about that situation as AEW is getting ready to get going, and just some of the things that have been floating around. You know, I don't think back then we would have thought a situation like this would be possible.
No, there were and after that, even worse, once AEW got off the ground, some of the feelings that had taken place. But, yeah, you know, Harold May out of the way, and it went from there. And the bottom line was, it was apparent for New Japan, you know, just the way things went anyway, things were going to go the way they were with COVID and everything else. So they were going to get hit in the face, but it obviously became apparent that AEW was quickly going to become that number two promotion. And not only that, we're going to dominate the scene. And at some point you're going to have to probably play nice with AEW, and frankly, vice versa. And all that has now happened. So the rumors started last week, the Super J cast, all credit to them. You know, even by their own admission, look, we're wildly speculating here, but this is something we had heard. And the rumor was June 23rd on a Thursday, which sent everybody kind of into a tizzy going, okay, well, they're in Milwaukee on Wednesday. Who was going to be, you know, the Cubs aren't there. The Cubs are going to be on the road. Who's going to be, well, there's going to be a concert. How can this work? Is it possible for this to work? People are like, who runs the management company of these bands? You know, Tony Khan's got something to do with that. Yeah. They use the same state. Like,
it's a lot of sleuthing going on. I felt like we're going to be looking at plane diagrams and things as well, like with CM Punk.
And it made it, you know, and it's amusing. You know, like in hindsight, like, I can't say anything bad. I'm not busting anybody's balls
or
anything like that. But it was fun to kind of see happen, especially as over the weekend, by denials, it started to become more and more apparent that this was looking much more likely than a streaming service.
Well, by lack of denials, that was the thing. No one was confirming it, but no one was issuing full denials. And that, you know, you usually know where that goes.
Yeah, and it went exactly the way it did. So June 26th, a Sunday, United Center, Chicago. Chicago, the official home of professional wrestling everywhere, you know, not the least of which for...
Honestly, with good reason. I know I live here, so I'm biased, but when you look at that crowd that they had for the New Japan show at the Odeon in Villa Park in suburban Chicago compared to the crowds that New Japan has gotten for other shows with comparable talent in the U.S., it's just another example of, well, you know, like if you want more shows outside of Chicago, get more wrestling fans in your city and maybe that'll happen.
Well, people used to bust balls on Baltimore. A lot of people over and over again, they would see it in the After magazine, oh, Baltimore, best city. But it's like, you know, if you were there and actually felt the crowd and all that sort of stuff, you'd understand why, you know, the 7,000 you got in are better than your 17 maybe in your city. But like in, you know, with Chicago, when's the last time they've had a dead ass crowd or a bad crowd for an event? You know, I mean, it's been a while. So, you know.
Yeah, no, it's also interesting. Just, I know we aren't an AEW podcast, and I'm happy about that, even though I enjoy AEW quite a bit. A lot of the time there's enough people covering that. But from an AEW calendar standpoint, it's interesting in that, you know, they've got Memorial Day weekend, Double or Nothing, and then you've got in early September for Labor Day weekend, you've got All Out. And so now you've got this pay-per-view that's basically 1 month after that Memorial Day weekend with Double or Nothing. So they've kind of changed, at least for once here, changed their four pay-per-views a year deal. In this case, it's going to be, you know, 1 month after their last one. I don't think it's going to be a big impact to the negative, just because this is such a unique, hopefully not, but potentially one-off show. I think people will see it as such and will be willing to pay. It is interesting in the sense that they're running Chicago with two pay-per-views in the span of, what, about 2.5 months? Because I can't fathom that All Out isn't going to be at the Now Arena, the former Sears Center in suburban Chicago, like it is every year.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't think it's going to matter. I don't think the way AEW is looking at this, they're looking at this as a joint pay-per-view. So anybody that comes, well, you're running Chicago back-to-back. We are running it with New Japan, which is different than just us running it. And I, you know, and you know, look, Chicago is just, it's easy to fly into. It's the center of the country, and it's a huge hub, obviously, for United and you know, for other places, it's easy to get in and out of. So, yeah, until you burn it out, you know, you keep going there. But I don't think they're going to burn it out either. I would not foresee a whole lot. Look, they have the entire West Coast they still have not gone to. So I think the other thing is interesting, and I know this doesn't necessarily fit into this, but when it comes to Warrior and AAW and everybody else who runs the Chicagoland area, has there been any fatigue that you know of or that and you've heard of from anybody else that's been running because so many big groups, New Japan?
Don't get me excited. If All Japan comes, I'm ready for that too. Give me a U.S. champion carnival date.
Oh, the three major companies, you know, run a lot there. Is there any fatigue amongst fans or in that entire area for other shows?
Not that I've seen. I mean, because I think, I mean, when you look at, you know, let's say Warrior, the last time they ran in the Chicago area, whatever it was, like a month or two ago in Cicero, they had a good like 600 people, nearly sold out. You know, place was really packed. And I mean, those are your hardest of the hardcore fans that if there's a big show that people want to go to every month, they're going to go to it. So I don't think it's going to burn out. Or I don't think it has burned out yet. You know, that hardest of the hardcore fan base. I mean, I think the one thing that is notable, though, is if you go back and look at the last time AEW ran in Chicago for that Dynamite episode that was nowhere near sold out. It was a good crowd. And a lot of people use the excuse of the snowstorm that was in the area that night, why they didn't really clear much more than 5,000 fans. But I mean, that was like the tickets sold before there was a snowstorm announced. It's not like people didn't show up. it was, you know, it was a bit of a rougher sell. And so I think that will be one thing to watch with AEW is if they're running this many big shows, you know, you're running two pay-per-views, you know, whatever, I would imagine they'll also run, you know, at least a Dynamite with a Rampage taping after, if not a Dynamite and Rampage separately for All Out week. It may be a bit of a tough sell for other times of the year when they come just for a Dynamite. You know, they may have to space those out a little bit more. On the New Japan front, the timing absolutely lines up perfectly for this show, for the big super show, in terms of being after Dominion and being before the G1. I don't know that we're at a point yet to where we can even begin to really speculate on what matches will be on this show. But I've seen some people, you know, say, well, this is just going to be, it's just going to be a bunch of tags. It'll just be, you know, Okada teaming with the Best Friends against the Factory. Like, they're not coming to the United Center to run all tag team matches. Yes, there will be, like there was on this Windy City Riot show, there will be some probably 8, 10, maybe even 12-man tags because they're going to want to get a lot of people on this show. But I would fall over shocked if we don't have a big Okada singles match, if there isn't a big CM Punk singles match, if there isn't a big Bryan Danielson singles match, if let's say, you know, Naito or Tanahashi isn't in a big singles match, like they're this is going to be a big deal. I have full confidence this is going to more resemble a Wrestle Kingdom show than a Corican Hall show.
It's going to be a fascinating G1. It really is. Who they decide to take, you know, there's going to be, and look, there's going to be, unless you're going to run a 32-person G1, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be upset that X wrestler isn't in there, whether that is Tom.
Do you really think people are going to be upset if Yujiro Takahashi is held out?
No, but I bet you there will be people upset if, you know, Filthy's not in, or if, you know, say Jeff Cobb's not in because
Cobb will be in. There's no doubt Jeff Cobb will
be in. I agree with that, but I you know, I'm just using him as an example of, okay, well, we got Danielson, Moxley, you start picking out names and it's like, okay, there's a squeeze here, and so, you know, somebody's going to be out. And
well, yeah, someone's going to be out, but if you've, I mean, you look at the lineup of the last few G1s, I think that's okay. I think that's totally
fine.
We need someone to be out. we'll get into it in a few minutes. The lineups for these, you know, these New Japan shows, you know, the recent ones and the ones coming up, if a few of the guys that are normally on these shows aren't on them, that's totally fine. And I also don't think from a AEW presence standpoint for the G1, people need to be overly concerned about that, meaning, you know, there won't be room for, you know, a Tom Lawler or a Fred Ross or someone like that if New Japan wants to have them in the G1, because AEW isn't going to, I'd be shocked if they send 2, 3, 4 guys to be gone for a month to do this tournament. My guess is if it happens, you're going to see one significant guy, whether that be a Moxley or a Danielson, probably one of those two guys. I'd be very surprised if the numbers got much higher than that.
No, but when you factor in Will Ospreay, who did end up going back, but Jay White, you know, it's like, it's, man, it's, again, it makes it, it does make it, though, much better, much more intriguing. And frankly, because of COVID, because of New Japan's booking, because of just general G1 fatigue, you know, it's compared to the last 10 years as Adam falls over in shock, you know, it's, you know, it's. I'm very much looking forward to this year. And this is, you know, with just having the opportunity to get some of these names in there again.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it,
First time.
What's that?
Or in Danielson's case for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I look at it as similar to, you know, and I think of it as like a hockey team or a baseball team where there isn't a lot of competition in preseason / spring training, and you know everyone is going to be in, and it's the same guys who were on the team last year, and it's just, you know, everyone sort of feels comfortable. We're not going to have that heading into this year's G1 for the first time in quite a while, barring something crazy happening. You know, there's going to be the possibility of people coming in. I mean, look at in other promotions right now in Japan, the floodgates are starting to open as far as bringing in outsiders. Noah's bringing in everybody. I mean, Jesus, they're even bringing in Simon Gotch to wrestle Masakatsu Funaki on April 30th. Glate just announced that Jack Cartwheel is coming in next month. So, you know, it's
really.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe for the same May 18th show that Shima and Shingo Takagi are going to be teaming as part of Shima's big anniversary.
Holy shit. I tell you, boy, I like Cartwheel. Well, that's a different story for a different day, but God damn, he's an athlete. Holy shit.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's with things starting to open up, the, you know, the possibilities begin to open up as well. The other thing that just before we get to some of these upcoming New Japan shows, the lineup for Stardom at the end of the year, I did also want to mention, because I've seen people speculate that, you know, if Kenny Omega is healthy, which that's a big if, but if he's healthy and ready to wrestle on this show, you know, who would he wrestle? You know, and there's no way they would do Omega Okada again in the, they wouldn't do that in the US, and there's no way Okada would win if that was the case. I think if Omega's healthy, there's no way they wouldn't do Omega versus Okada in the US. And I think if they do it, if you're ever going to have Okada get the win that he was supposed to have, that he was supposed to get at Madison Square Garden in 2019, that would be the time to do it, because it's Omega coming off injury. So from a kayfabe standpoint, from a storyline standpoint, AEW and Omega would have the out of, you know, well, he's still coming back from injury. Yeah, I'm not saying that's going to happen, because it seems fairly unlikely that Omega is going to be ready by then. But it seems like things would line up quite well for that to happen if he was healthy.
Yeah, it's, and you know, when's Ibushi coming back? You know, obviously he was announced for the New Japan Cup. That was way, way premature.
Yeah, he still just now this week said he's 70-80%, and we're months after he was announced for the New Japan Cup and then pulled from it.
Yeah, and even if maybe, you know, even if he's working that number a little bit, the bottom line is he's not ready now.
No, well, no. If he was, he would be there. They need that.
And I can see why people would, if you're especially if you're looking at this from an AEW point of view, first and foremost of, my God, you know, do you want to do that? And my answer is yes, because you have the excuse again, you have the wrestling built in thing that both AEW, maybe not as much AEW, but certainly New Japan, he's coming back from an injury. Okada is the best wrestler in the world, or at least in the top percentile, no matter who you are. So I could absolutely see doing that. I wouldn't hurt my feelings doing that, as long as you know you're going to get some sort of return. And whether that's Omega going over Okada later, it's Omega winning the IWGP title from someone, it's something like that. As long as you know there's a plan there that may involve Kota Ibushi, you know, weaseled in there somewhere, not weaseled in, but weaved in some way. Yeah. I could see that. And I could also see just as strongly somebody saying, no, I don't want to do that for the first match, having Omega back. But it, to me, if you're going to, I mean, it is a big L to hang on him, but it's also, he's got the shoulders enough to carry it. And I don't think, again, you have all of those built in athletic excuses to where you can build to the next thing.
Yeah, 100% agree. The other thing just sort of floating out there, and it would be the obvious match to put together, but with both men potentially as world champions in their respective companies by the time June 26 gets here, maybe it wouldn't happen. But, you know, CM Punk versus Kazuchika Okada is, you know, you'd have to think is a pretty big option. There's no way that Punk is not going to be wrestling, in my mind, either Okada, Naito, or Tanahashi on that show.
Whew, man.
And in some ways, Tanahashi might be the play, because Tanahashi is, I firmly believe on that show, he is going to be the guy that loses to a top AEW star to make up for whatever top New Japan guy is beating a top AEW guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the one. And did we talk about it last show with Tanahashi? And I talked about it with somebody not all that long ago. Like, Tanahashi, he can take the loss.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's as Teflon as it gets. I mean, that's what he is now. He's the guy that gets just enough big wins, including occasionally in championship matches, that He still is seen as a top level guy, but he can drop the falls. In some ways, he's like how New Japan sends, you know, the likes of Suzuki, Ishii, Nagata to the U.S., where they are seen in the pecking order by fans in the U.S. as being much higher in the New Japan hierarchy than they in actuality are. So you can send them to the U.S. They're big stars. It doesn't necessarily hurt the cards in Japan. And if you have them lose, it, you know, it's not a big deal.
No, and that's where I would have a little concern for Jay White. And obviously I'm deep in the tank for Jay White, and Jay White has, you know, he's like Lazarus. He can almost lose to anybody and be okay, but I would still want to be careful with him. But if that US of J Open Challenge leads to Brian Danielson or leads to, you know, again, you can,
well, Kenny Omega. I mean, that's the other option. Yeah. That if Omega is back and you do something like Okada versus CM Punk or Brian Danielson, then you've got, you know, Kenny Omega and Jay White and that, you know, ever simmering story. You know, that could happen there as well.
Yeah, there's
options. Believe it or not, there are a ton of options when you do New Japan versus AEW in a mega show at the United Center. You can book some good matches.
A few.
As far as on the New Japan front, one of the other things I just wanted to briefly touch on with you, because I think it's very relevant, and I think it's clear that if nothing else, New Japan has burned out one thing during these past 2+ years of pandemic-induced changes, and that's their Korakuen Hall shows. I don't know if you saw the crowd at the two shows this week on the 19th and the 20th. They only drew 374 fans for an Okada and Yo versus Naito and Bushi main event on the 19th, and then on the 20th, for a show that was Okada and Yo versus Naito and Hiromu Takahashi, they only drew 509 fans. Just for context, this is during a time where crowds are starting to edge up considerably for other promotions at Korakuen Hall. And I believe it was the 7th, Dragon Gate drew an announced 1,400 fans. We know Dragon Gate sometimes fudges the numbers a little bit, but still, it was a pretty close to full Korakuen Hall. Stardom drew just under 1,200 for the quarterfinals of the Cinderella tournament with really no marquee matches or title matches to speak of. And then you had, you know, somewhat in a different stratosphere, the two big Korakuen Hall 60th anniversary joint shows that drew like 1,300 and 1,600 respectively. But New Japan running Korakuen so often with these shows where they'll run 2, 3, even sometimes 4 nights in a row with very, very similar cards. You know, I don't think they've necessarily burned out Tokyo for their big shows, but they've burned it out for Korakuen.
I couldn't figure out for the life of me, why were there back-to-back shows on this tour?
Well, I think the answer to so much of what's happened with them at Korakuen is it's just generating content. They've got, you know, you look at both of these were Samurai TV shows, and they're Samurai TV exclusives in the sense that unlike really the entirety of the run of New Japan World up until the start of 2022, now these Samurai TV shows, they don't air live on New Japan World. They go up on New Japan World the next day. And one would think that change means that they probably got at least, and maybe it was only a small increase, but you'd have to imagine they got an increase in terms of what they're getting paid from Samurai TV to run these shows, you know, to have exclusivity on it. So I think it just boils down to wanting content for New Japan World, wanting content for partners like Samurai TV, and it being easier in a pandemic era to run, you know, just continue running Cork and continue running running Tokyo rather than touring as much as they would before. The flip side of that, and this is the case for so many ways, talking about where New Japan has gone wrong and how you could have done things differently, is looking at their corporate sisters over at Stardom and how they've just went all over the country, everywhere you could think of, towns and cities that haven't had major wrestling shows for years, if not ever. And then running Corican, you know, once a month at most, you know, that seems to have been the better strategy in terms of growing the brand, so to speak, and then also still not burning out your home base.
Well, it's like I was just looking through and it's like they didn't draw in March. They didn't draw in February. They didn't draw in January. And the only outlier would be March 18th with the New Japan Cup where Hiromu beat Evil.
And yes.
Actually broke 1,000. But man, 509, 374.
Well, and again, building two, and this will sort of serve as a transition to talking about the Wrestling Dontaku show. That's building two. What in theory and what people keep wanting to say is the biggest match that New Japan has to offer on the main roster, which is Okada versus Naito. Here you had the preview tags for that. They didn't draw at all. And you look at, Okada versus Naito, the two times they've done it so far this year, it's not as if, to use a Dave Meltzerism, they've been knocking them dead in terms of attendance. I mean, that Okada Naito match in the New Japan Cup, if I'm mistaken, didn't draw much more than 2,000.
Well, I mean, it's the way this thing was presented. You know, there's times where it's like, you know, there's Naito saying something or Okada saying something, and it may be their real feelings. It may be ribbing on the square. It may be them just, you know, fluffing it up for the media, but it's like in this occasion where Naito could not figure out why Okada wanted him to have the match with him, it's like, yeah, I kind of don't understand that either. As much as, you know, I love watching these two wrestle, what are we doing here again?
Yeah, that doesn't indicate a great build.
This championship again.
What's that?
It's like Naito's never seeing this championship again because he's, you know, again, gone after it so many times now, hasn't gotten. And it's like he's going to take, I would assume, an L here again.
I have zero doubt.
So it's like, I don't know.
He's Teflon too, but yeah, it's any doubt that I had about Okada running the table this year as IWGP World Champion heading into next year at Wrestle Kingdom was erased when he, you know, fairly easily disposed of Zack Sabre Jr. A couple weeks back after that run that Sabre went on in the New Japan Cup. I really thought there was at least a slight possibility that Sabre would get a win and then drop it back to Okada, you know, maybe in an immediate rematch or after one defense. After going through that and the way that match was presented, where yes, it was good and it was competitive, but you know, Sabre didn't even last as long as he did against Okada 4 years prior. I'm pretty convinced that Okada is going to run the table. And this will be very good, but it's indicative of how much New Japan has run the same matchups into the ground that, like, I'm really not that excited about Okada versus Naito, and I will be once the bell rings and the match starts. But from an anticipation standpoint, it just, you know, I've seen it and it'll be good, but it's, you know, I'm ready for something else. You know, they drew just over 3,700 in Sapporo on February 20th for the IWGP World Heavyweight Title match. And then they drew just over 2,000. So not exactly a huge crowd on March 26th in a cavernous building. In, I believe that was in Osaka Joe Hall. Just over 2,000 people in a, 13,000-14,000 seat building. So, we shall see how things go, in the massive PayPay Dome in Fukuoka. That's the other element of this show coming up on May 1st is that while, before the pandemic, things certainly seem to be trending to New Japan being able to run the building formerly known as the Fukuoka Dome. You know, they had run, you know, two big shows and it had big crowds in the big arena. And so it was looking like they could do this. Like, this has the potential to really not be a good atmosphere for what should be one of their biggest shows of the year if it's as empty as it probably will be.
Well, this is just the setup show for Capital Collision anyway.
It's the go-home show.
We get some match announcements. And, oh, by the way, 2 weeks. separate those shows the same way 2 weeks separate Dominion and Forbidden Door. So yeah.
Well, it'll be very interesting to compare the quality of those shows, because again, I thought if you take away the streaming issues and just look at the shows, I thought that even on a rewatch, the Windy City Riot show blew away the Hyper Battle show, you know, and so we're going to have another very close comparison of Capital Collision and Wrestling Dontaku. And then we'll have another very close comparison of the Dominion show and the Forbidden Door show.
If you're New Japan, do you want Will Ospreay to lose in the United States at any point?
Well, I mean, he just did to John Moxley a couple days ago.
He did in controversial fashion.
Yes.
But I think that'll play into something with the Blackpool Combat Club and the United Empire. If you talk about one of the, you know, what could be a six-man, you know, situation, that's possible. It's within the realm of possibility. The problem with that, though, for some show, but the problem with that for either DC or Chicago is it takes Moxley, you know, in DC it's Moxley and Tanahashi anyway, but it takes them out of singles matches. But with Ospreay, the only catch I could see with Okada running the table this year is because I to me it's like, okay, Okada and Ibushi, with Ibushi, you know, one of the nights getting, you know, the win in the championship if he's healthy, I think would be an idea for
it. Would be an idea. I don't think it's going to happen though, but sorry, go ahead.
No, but I think what could also be just as likely or even more likely is Ospreay picks up the belt this year, because for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is you have that Ospreay Hiromu match night one at the Dome, and then you can have Ospreay Okada or Ospreay Naito, or, you know, better case scenario, Ospreay and Ibushi. And I think that could be something that could work. Look, they obviously, Ospreay is very important. He is, you know, to me, as much as I love Jay White, you know, if I'm looking to protect somebody from this point forward, you know, as far as my English speaking, you know, representative, you know, for North America or, you know, this relationship, I want to keep Will Ospreay as safe as almost anybody else on that roster, not named Okada.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I think to your point about this, you know, the Ospreay getting screwed storyline, I think whenever they get through that, I think you will 100% see Ospreay getting as protected as you're talking about. I think if we weren't in the 50th anniversary year, I could see the scenario that you're talking about as far as Ospreay regaining the championship being likely. But I don't see anything in the presentation of New Japan Pro Wrestling in 2022 in the 50th anniversary year that tells me that this year is going to be about anything other than cementing Kazuchika Okada as the unrivaled face of New Japan, the guy that is considered, you know, at least obviously in kayfabe, you know, the biggest star, the guy that represents the first 50 years of New Japan and going into the next 50 years. So I don't know. I think there's a good chance that he loses the belt to someone on the second night of Wrestle Kingdom in 2023. But I think you will see him run the table this year and, you know, win that first night, if it is, in fact, two nights of Wrestle Kingdom. To your point on Will Ospreay and dropping falls, he's in the semi-main event of Wrestling Dontaku, taking on Hiroshi Tanahashi in a decision match for the IWGP US title, which one has to assume would have been Ospreay versus Sonata if Sonata had not been injured in that match with Ospreay. But it certainly makes for a compelling match in that you've got Tanahashi 2 weeks later wrestling Jon Moxley in the United States. A Jon Moxley who's a former United States champion, and if things are opening up and he's going to continue to be involved more and more with New Japan, it's not out of the realm of possibility that they would want to get the U.S. title back on Jon Moxley. So do you launder it through Hiroshi Tanahashi here?
Yes. Here's why. I think, you know, for exactly the reason that you mentioned, he can come over here and lose and not miss a beat. And Ospreay, he doesn't need it. You know, if you wanted to do it, it's fine. There's a story you can tell with it. Having all the United Empires with belts would be cool with me. I would completely understand that story. But Tanahashi coming over here let's say, losing it to somebody like a Moxley, and then Moxley turning around and losing it to someone who eventually somebody from New Japan could beat, whether that be someone in AEW, whether that be somebody with a New Japan strong relationship.
Maybe down the line, if he comes back and he's ready, maybe Moxley loses it to show it to Umino.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And maybe that is what allows Show to Umino entrance into Blackpool Combat Club.
Yeah. And if you do something like that, again, New Japan's happy. AEW's happy. You know, the dojo is happy. You look at it, it actually works from every angle. Moxley could lose to, even if it's somebody else on the roster, as long as it's somebody with, you know, a name who, again, you can turn around and beat with. It's not going to be, but Alex Coughlin or literally anybody that you want. I mean, this whole thing could work. Again, politics don't have to get in the way of, you know, telling these stories, because there's enough wiggle room with guys on this roster who can take wins and losses and you can have them make logical sense. It's just when ego, if ego gets involved, which hopefully doesn't happen, because again, I making this a super show type of deal from the 90s where everybody's, you know, trying to battle for the front page of the sports, you know.
Well, you don't even have to go to the 90s. Look at all the everything that played out with the New Japan Noah show earlier this year, particularly on the Keiji Muto side. I don't think he'll be booked on this show, so we probably won't have to worry about that. But, I mean, those things can still take place in 2022. I mean, there were sort of two sets of plans from everything that it seems as far as for the New Japan versus Noah show at Wrestle Kingdom, one of which was going to have a bunch of big singles matches. The other was have a bunch of tag matches to allow for sort of the, you know, traditional obvious pin eaters to drop falls and keep everyone happy politically. And we saw how that played out. I don't think that's going to play out that way here, just because I don't know that, you know, the U.S. fan base will buy a show, literally and figuratively buy a show filled with 6 and 8 man tags and no big singles matches. But those politics can still come into play even in modern times.
Well, especially looking from New Japan side there, you know, if I say this and I tend to believe this, I'm not saying this universal, but AEW fans, the American fans, I'm not saying they don't give a shit who loses, but we would be far more forgiving if our favorite New Japan fan, even if you're a number one New Japan fan, if your guy got beaten by an AEW fan, as long as the match was awesome and as long as it's not, you know, you know, whatever, the Evil Uno going over Okada, like, you know, as the match is good, people, again, it doesn't affect anything. It's where New Japan side is, I think, going to be, you know, again, it's politics and not the fans.
For sure. Well, I think to me that the most obvious thing is whoever Okada wrestles, if he's in a singles match, and it's not guaranteed that he will be, but if Okada's in a singles match on this show, he's beating whoever he wrestles at Forbidden Door. Similarly, in Chicago, for the first time since CM Punk lost twice in one match to MJF, CM Punk is beating whoever he wrestles on this show if it's a singles match. And then you sort of piece out the victories, dole them out from there. But from, you know, from a political standpoint, that would kind of be the way I would see things falling. Back to the Wrestling Don't Talk show quickly before we get going. We've also got Desperado versus Taiji Ishimori for the junior title in a match that I'm sure will be great. But kind of like with Okada and Naito, it's just hard to get excited about, you know, it's just, you know, Taiji Ishimori wrestling, you know, one of the same five people he's wrestled for the past 2 years, even if it's someone as great as Desperado. We've also got Evil versus Tama Tonga for the never open weight title in a match that I absolutely would not watch if I was not doing this podcast. Also, three-way tag title match, Great Okan, Jeff Cobb versus Hiroki Goto and Yoshihashi versus, for some godforsaken reason, Chase Owens and Bad Luck Fale. Like, when you watched Okan and Cobb versus Goto and Yoshihashi a couple weeks ago for the tag titles, very good match. Were you sitting there thinking, man, you know what this match could use? Some Chase Owens. I know you're in the tank for Chase Owens, you and Kevin Kelly, charter members of the fan club.
You know, again, I have a high appreciation for the effort he's put in and the sacrifices he's made. But Yeah, I mean, he's part of that pack that it's like, okay, this is why I need to see new blood.
Yes. Yes. It's the poster children. And again, like, they work hard. Bad Luck Fale, great trainer. Love the Lion's Roar series on New Japan World. If you haven't watched it, watch it. Awesome stuff. But it's, you know, I go back to seeing them in a major title scene. It's big Al Perez and World Class 1987 as world champion vibes.
I like Carl. And, you know, for a long time, I liked Carl and Doc. And, you know, them, if they came back, it would be, you know, new faces in. But it's like when you think about it and you pull it back, it's like, not really.
No.
To low end. It just and that's going to be the other interesting thing, too. You know, it just about. There's going to be some sort of Bullet Club and House of Torture, all that.
God, I didn't even think about that. We're probably going to have Evil and Dick Togo running roughshod at the United Center. Hopefully it's like Evil, Dick Togo and Sho against Orange Cassidy, Danhausen and someone else. Just so all the people I don't want to see on that show can be in one match together, and I can hit up the concessions, I can hit up the merch, I can hit up the bathroom, all in one fell swoop and not miss anything that I want to see.
And unfortunately, or fortunately, unfortunately, all that stuff with the Bullet Club House Torture needs to be shaken out, not only in Japan, but here, because, you know, Jay White and Chris Bay and you get all that. How are they going to fit in? Are they going to fit in? All that stuff is also going to have to be hashed out with these shows that are coming up too. So, you know, the asterisk gets attached to that. You did mention an interesting name too, like MJF is somebody that numbers wise and name wise does not fit on this show. And I wouldn't necessarily want to see him on.
Oh, he that. Will be. Think about his little subtle call outs, not even subtle, but he's been doing it for the last couple months, randomly posting on Twitter about how much New Japan sucks. Well, so
It's like
something will happen there. Maybe we get MJF and Hiroshi Tanahashi in the ultimate babyface versus heel match.
Who else has got a scarf in New Japan? Does anybody have a scarf in New Japan? But it's like, you know, even if he's not on the show in a wrestling capacity, that's where it's interesting to me, because I can see him not being on the show as with a match, but him doing something, you
maybe
know,
maybe something to set up whatever the next New Japan versus AEW thing is.
It is I'd rather see that than him and Sean Spears against let's say Bad Luck Fale and Chase Owens.
that is accurate. Something that definitely does not feel like that match would be Stardom's Cinderella Tournament final show coming up April 29th, Oda City General Gymnasium. Just about just over a week from today as we record this. One thing I'm very interested to see, and we're not going to spend a ton of time on this because we're almost at a G1 level show. We'll get into this more on next week's podcast. But I'm really interested to see what they draw at Oda City General Gymnasium. When you look at, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that they drew almost 1,200 people for the quarterfinals of this tournament at Korakuen Hall, a pretty remarkable number. Very interested to see what they do at Oda. We've got Mirai versus Natsu Poi in the Adam Summers Classic as far as the two wrestlers that I've been shouting from the rooftops for years before, and then when they got signed by Stardom, how big of stars they were going to be. That's one of the semifinals. Koguma versus Suzuki is the other semifinal. So we're guaranteed with whoever wins this tournament, you know, going on to the final taking place as the semi-main event of this show, whoever wins this tournament is going to be somebody who's being elevated to the highest point in their career, going on to challenge for either the white or red belt. If I had to guess, I would say Natsu Poi. I would see her winning the tournament and then getting a rematch with Saya Kamatani and being the person to end that reign and become the winner of Stardom champion. But considering how over Mirai is, if you've been watching the shows and hearing people clap along with her music and then continue with that clap run as she's trying to cut promos, I could see her winning. I think whoever wins the tournament is going to come out of that half of the bracket. It's going to be either Mirai or Natsu Poi.
I agree. And I think Natsu Poi makes sense. And Natsu Poi defeating Mirai and then defeating
probably Hazuki, I would say. Although Koguma I mean, she can beat anyone at any time. We've seen that before. That would be a good nod for her to get to the final as well.
That is true. I like the way that Himeka has set up her match with Siouri for the World of Stardom title, trying to throw her off there with the big kiss. I mean,
yeah, yeah, and playing off of also the similar thing that happened with Siouri and Hayashishita last year. I don't think there's any doubt it's the biggest match of Himeka's career, and I think for a lot of people, you know, like me, who have been waiting to see her get a big singles push, or at least, you know, get put into a big singles championship match, like, this is it's pretty exciting. And their exchange that they had in the tag match preview at Cork and Hall a couple days ago was really, really good. So I expect Siouri to win, but I expect that to be a great match. The sleeper, if you can call it that, on this show, and, you know, maybe has potential to be right there with Izumi and Starlight Kid from a few months ago. Third from the top, Izumi defending the high speed title against Mei Suruga. My God, that's going to be awesome.
Mm-hmm. And that's, when is the, because I thought it was on here and it's not. It would be May 5th, right? So Mika and Saya Kamatani.
Yes, yes, that is coming up on May 5th. Also on that show, it's the new God's Eye Sable led by Siouri, joined for 1 week only by Konami, coming back. Never end, at least on a limited basis, to take on Donna Del Mondo 4-on-4 elimination. Also, Thekla versus Mayu Iwatani on that May 5th show in Fukuoka.
Some special right there.
What's that?
The Adam special right here.
That'll be fantastic as well. And then tag title rematch, the Fukushima natives, the Fukuoka natives, Hazuki and Koguma getting their rematch against Momo Watanabe and Starlight Kid for the Goddesses of Stardom tag team titles. It'll actually be interesting to see. And I'm sure it won't be that close because Fukuoka International Center is not a huge building. But what the delta is between the crowd for the PayPay Dome New Japan show and this Stardom show in the same building, or in the same city, I should say, on May 5th. I'm sure there'll be thousands of people difference, but I'm fascinated by that decision for New Japan to run the Fukuoka Dome on the first. So that's why I'm relating it here. But exciting shows for Stardom coming up at the end of April into the beginning of May.
I'm still betting I'm still hoping for their sake that it's cheap rent. That's got to be what it is.
Yeah, and I think that's the story for a lot of these buildings, a lot of these shows. I mean, there can't be any other explanation. Talk about cheap rent and big buildings. That can be the only explanation for why we're getting two nights of Pro Wrestling NOAH at Sumo Hall, April 29th and 30th, and the 29th being a junior heavyweight only show for NOAH. That disaster of a junior heavyweight division is going to have a full show on the 29th at Sumo Hall. That is, I can only imagine how small of a crowd that's going to be.
Small crowd for All Japan and Korakuen too.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, it's indicative. I wrote about it a little bit in Three Count Fall last week, how great the Champion Carnival has been, but also how still wholly dependent they are on big Kento Miyahara singles matches being the thing that draws at Cork. And they didn't have that, and they only drew about 400 people.
Yeah, well, Champions Carnival is taking place. We'll be getting into that more next show.
It's worth watching. I'll just say that if you like good, like 18 to 15 minute hard hitting matches with the occasional match that goes to a 30 minute draw, this is the tournament for you. Takuya Nomura from Big Japan has been great, as has been T-Hawk from a great. So yeah, definitely check that out if you get a chance.
Yeah, it's basically like, if you have the time, as I was basically described to me, oh, if it's good, if you got the time, you know, it's, well, yes. I don't have the time, unfortunately, to check.
Which it's a dangerous caveat because no one ever has the time.
No, especially not in this day and age. No, which is why I, like you, should subscribe to Three Count Fall, your Substack blog written by Adam Summers with everything you need to know taking place in the world of Japanese professional wrestling.
Oh, thank you. That was quite the plug. And yes, issue 15, I believe, will be coming out on Friday, going more into my my live experience at Windy City Riot and just how surreal it was to be sitting down in the Odeum, the former home of ECW in Chicago, and being mere feet away from the cerulean blue mat after so many decades as a kid into adulthood of pining for a show, a proper New Japan show in Chicago. So talk about that. The Stardom, obviously, some thoughts about the breaking news of the Forbidden Door show, and a quick hit around around Japan. I even have thoughts on a match I watched from the Wave promotion. So kind of hit on everything coming this Friday. And then also, as always, if you enjoyed hearing Jeremy Deamer here with me in the first segment here on the podcast, you can hear him and I do the Wrestling at Random show for free every Sunday at WrestlingAtRandom.com or wherever you find podcasts. As the name of the show indicates, we just watch random wrestling every week and talk about it. It's fun. It's it can get pretty wacky at times. We are true professionals, though, doing the podcast, and I think you will enjoy it.
That's what I love about three count fall. One of the things I love about it, that third fall, which has got just a little hodgepodge of stuff in there from everywhere. And, you know, even if it didn't have that, I would love the way you laid out your three count fall a lot more than, you know, Toru Yano would.
What's that? Sorry, I cut out for a second.
No, just it was my joke, which fell flat, which deserved to.
The audio cut out. Tell it again. The good folks, if it was great, they'll like to hear it a second time.
Well, it goes like this. Your three count fall that you have in there, a lot better than Toru Yano's three count fall that he has got planned for his King of Pro Wrestling Provisional Championship.
The 30 count fall. Maybe I can if I ever go to a partial pay model for three count fall and enough people support it financially, I can change it to 30 count fall and cover everything in even more excruciating detail, much like one of the options for the upcoming KOPW match between Shingo Takagi and Taichi on April 25th.
Holy Moses. But, hey, you know, since we haven't done a show since it happened, to old news for everybody, but still, Shinjiro Otani.
Yes.
The injury that he suffered. God, what day was it? It's been April 10th now.
Yep, April 10th. So it's been 10 or 11 days at this point, and not a whole lot of news to the positive as far as any change in the status of him, you know, not having feeling in his arms or legs after taking that corner German suplex.
Yeah, and I have there's nothing to really add. You know, we've seen this so many times now, and just you just hope his quality of life is there. Forget, you know, I would love to see maybe one day he comes out of that, you know, everything like Hayabusa, but I just want him to be comfortable. I want his family to be comfortable, however that is. And all thoughts and prayers go to him, and just hopefully cross your fingers as a miracle that he starts to somehow regain that feeling and that things can change for him, because he's a guy that, he's one of those guys at some point, you know, for the 50th anniversary, we probably should bring up some guys from the past. And
absolutely.
Do the old list thing that everybody can banter about and have fun with or get really angry about or both, you know, want to do it. But, you know, Otani's one of those guys that for like Adam and I, if you're of our age and of our time, you know, it was him and Wild Pegasus and
Koji Kanemoto and yes. Jushin Liger. I mean, I just think of seeing Otani for the first time, other than just in terrible video quality, you know, seeing him on pay-per-view against Eddie Guerrero at Starrcade 95 and just being absolutely blown away. I mean, as a wrestler, the thing that was so noteworthy was that the presentation was so basic. No knee pads, short black boots, black trunks, not just as a young lion, but deep into his career as a top wrestler. But when you got past that, he was one of the most expressive guys, one of the guys that drew you in the most with his facial expressions, just with the way he moved. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that face wash, which everybody does, you know.
Yes.
Otani was the first one I saw do it on a regular and do it really, really well. his team and feud with Kanemoto, where they would just, you know, he was almost slapping Kanemoto young boy style. And then, you know, Takaiwa getting introduced into that later on, and those two battling against each other, those two teaming against Liger and Samurai, matches with Ultimo Guerrero, all that Ultimo Guerrero, Ultimo Dragon, all that sort of stuff. What, Eddie Guerrero, Black Tiger, all that. It just, man, you know, he's lived several lives, because it wasn't long after that came Hustle and, you know, 01 Max and all that stuff. And then, you know, just an amazing long career. And just, again, he's one of those guys we probably should do. One of the guys we should do a deep dive into at some point, because I think there's a lot of people that, you know, they're I'm not saying they're eating off Otani, but they probably don't even realize he was the first WCW Cruiserweight champion.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just, I'm just sad. And he's one of those guys that, I mean, we love talking about him. You know, you go back to old shows, years talk about Otani and talking about this sort of stuff. And, you know, this was a reminder of just, you know, how crazy life can be, and also how, you know, it's a reminder ended up being how great, you know, he was, and hopefully can continue to be.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And while wrestling is far from the most important thing, you know, it's noteworthy as well from a wrestling standpoint how, you know, very deep into his career, how great of a performer he still was. We talked about on this podcast last year before he suffered the arm injury, how great he was in the Champion Carnival in 2021, and how much of a revelation that was for some people who, you know, the relative obscurity of 01, they had not seen much of him in recent years. You know, this match that he had against Sugiura, the ill-fated match, that was his comeback from that significant arm injury. So, yeah, it's hard to know what else to say. I mean, you just hope that, you know, I know several more days have gone by, but you hope that there can be some sort of, you know, miraculous recovery like there was for a guy like Tomoaki Honma, who for the first several days after he suffered that injury years ago, you know, things were looking really, really dire, and, you know, somehow things started to improve. So you just, you know, you can't help but hold out some sort of hope that we can see a similar result and resolution and change in the status of Otani. But beyond that, like you said, just hope the best for him, for his family. Hope the situation changes, that at least going forward, his family can visit him in the hospital. I know there have been some reports that even that hasn't been possible due to the ongoing COVID situation in Japan. So, you know, if nothing else, short term, hope that changes and it can move from video calls to actually having his family there with him. But on that obviously very down note, we should end the podcast because we are probably a good 2 hours in, and G1 is nowhere to be found, so we don't need to be crossing the 120-minute barrier.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a feeling we're probably going to be pushing it pretty close here coming to these shows over the next few months here. We
probably
may have a 2-hour point at some point. So, but, you know, again, hey, it's a good time to be a wrestling fan. It really, really is. You know, if you just turn off your social media and watch the wrestling, I think you'll be okay.
That's always a good option. Turn off the social media. And as I am fond of saying in recent months, if you're involved in wrestling in any capacity, you know, tweeting through it, never a good idea.
Don't do it.
On that note, let's close it out. Unless that was you closing it out. We can't stop.
That was going to be me closing it out, but now we shall do it with a hot tag to the end.